You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Welcome everybody to the Berkman Center. What a great group we have. So Ruha is a Berkman Center fellow this year. She's also the executive director of the Internet Bar Organization, which works on a number of initiatives trying to improve, working towards justice through technology. One particular initiative that she focuses on is Peace Tones, but that's not what she's talking about today. She's talking about CONI 2012, which is of interest to, I think, a lot of different groups, which is why so many different groups are represented here. So welcome, Ruha.
Thanks, Amar. And thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm really excited about having all you guys in the room, especially Invisible Children people and ICC people, because I'm talking about both a little bit. So the reason I decided to do a presentation on CONI 2012 is not because I'm an expert in it by any means, but because the phenomenon really, really interests me as a practitioner in the field. As Amar mentioned, I run a nonprofit that does access to justice work through technology. One of our projects is a musicians advocacy project where we work with musicians around the world trying to use social media and teaching them about social media and how to use those tools to gain exposure for their own music. And the musicians we work with all have social justice messages to their music. So I think for me and for a lot of practitioners in the field, CONI 2012 is a really great example and a really great learning tool. So I'll be going through some of the positive aspects of the campaign, some of the negatives and the criticisms as well, but mostly to learn from them. And you know, I think overall it's a really, really great campaign because of the impact it's had. So I would just like to see a show of hands. How many people have actually seen the CONI 2012 video? Okay, good. And how many have seen some of the follow-up videos? Okay. So, and I will go through it a little bit just for those of you who are listening in or those of you who haven't seen the video or videos yet. So, CONI 2012 came out in early March of 2012, and it was a video campaign created by a nonprofit called Invisible Children, who focus on the conflict in Uganda and the surrounding countries between the LRA, which the Lord's Resistance Army, and the governments of those countries. So this conflict has been going on for over two decades. It's winding down now, but it is still ongoing. The LRA still does exist. CONI is still out there. And this campaign was created to bring an end to the conflict and to have Joseph CONI arrested and tried at the ICC. He has already been indicted at the ICC, and so the campaign calls for basically countries to follow up on their obligations to capture him and bring him to the court so he can be tried. So there are some main elements that I'll go through of this particular video. And then after that, I'll go through some of the critiques of the video and the follow-up that Invisible Children did on those critiques. One thing that really interests me, and I think interests a lot of nonprofits working in today's day and age, is how do you captivate an audience and how do you capture their attention when they are so saturated by audio, visual, textual media, by the news, by entertainment media? How do you capture their attention and bring it to something that isn't really something people want to think about? People don't want to think about violence and murder and torture, and especially when it's in another country and on another continent, it's even further removed from you. So how do you bring that to the attention of an audience that is is otherwise saturated with a whole bunch of other things. So Invisible Children's target audience is the millennials, which is people who were born after 1980, and I'm technically included in that category, but I feel like I'm aging out a little bit. So it's a generation after mine, I would say. And they are generally portrayed as very media savvy, very tech savvy, but also very apathetic when it comes to politics and especially world affairs. So it's an especially hard age group to target when you're trying to bring attention to international human rights issues. And one extremely impressive thing about the Kony 2012 video is it is currently the most viral video that was ever made. It reached 100 million views in less than a week, and it was about an issue that even people who are international relations savvy or international affairs savvy, an issue that sort of dropped off our radar. So the LRA, the civil conflict in northern Uganda and the DRC and Sudan, Sudan was in the attention of the world last year and a couple years ago, but that's dropped off as well. And so Kony 2012 sought to revive attention on that particular issue. And the main elements of the video are both the strength of the campaign and the weakness. When people critique the campaign, often it's these very same things that they critique. One that the campaign personalizes and emotionalizes an issue that is much more complex and involves many more actors, but personalizing involves bringing it down to one person or a group of people that may not really be on the ground in northern Uganda. For example, this video starts off with, it talks about social networks and the power of social networks and the power of us being young, Western, middle-income audiences based here in the U.S. mostly. They start off with a whole series of YouTube clips that have caught on, have become viral memes here in the States. For example, this one is of a 29-year-old hearing herself speak for the first time, and it's a really emotional clip. The point of putting this in the Kony 2012 video is to elicit emotion. Elicit emotion and have you connect with the video on a level that has nothing to do with Uganda, has nothing to do with Joseph Kony. And this has been a criticism of the campaign. They also did something very interesting and very, very personal, which is to bring into the video as a protagonist the head of the organization. So this is Jason Russell, and this is one of the most intimate moments of a person's life. His wife is giving birth to their son, and they put this scene in the video because it's one of those moments in your life that you have the most visceral, guttural reactions, and that's what they're trying to elicit. And you'll notice in the video that Jason has an Invisible Children bracelet on. So if you are familiar with the symbolism, it ties things in. The video then goes on to bring in, for the first time, Jacob, who is a Ugandan person who Jason met on his very first trip to Uganda. And his friendship with Jacob is part of what Jason Russell cites as one of his main ties to the cause. And one very clever thing that they did was to tie in the social media arc, the social media narrative, with the Ugandan narrative. Now, Jason actually met Jacob in Uganda before Facebook even existed, but the way they tie it in is they go through a Facebook timeline animation on the video, and they scroll down the timeline sidebar down to 2003, which is before Facebook existed, to show the narrative of how Jason and Jacob met, which is a really clever way of integrating the social media and the connectedness narrative with the Uganda narrative. And then the video goes into the conflict itself, but again, it goes into it on a very simple, personal level. And the audience is helped to connect with the conflict by being introduced to just one person, one child, and that child's grief. And this scene is extremely emotional, and I think is extremely well done, because it's very hard to give victims of conflict, to personalize the grief of victims of conflict, and to give it the same currency as your own grief. And in this film, I think they did a really, really good job of doing that. And you see Jacob talking about his brother here, and you can tell he doesn't do this often. He doesn't talk about it. He doesn't think about it. But Jason brings it out of him, and he breaks down and weeps, and it's captured in the film. Again, this could be seen as sensationalizing grief, making Ugandans monolithic as victims. You know, these are some of the criticisms that are brought in. But I think on a basic level, the intention was not that. The intention was to create a connection, create an emotional connection. And that's the arc that you see throughout the entire video. Another thing that you realize when you're watching this video is that Jason Russell and the camp and the organization started or came into this conflict on a very personal, basic and naive level. At this point in the film, Jason says to Jacob, "We're going to stop them," and it's just his immediate reaction to someone else's grief is to say, "I'll help you. I'll figure it out. I'll get you out of this." And he says later, "I had no idea how I was going to do it. I figured that out later." And that again is seen as problematic by many critics, because you have a Westerner going into an extremely complex situation and jumping into the savior role before he even knows how he's going to do it. That's the criticism, but on the personal level, we all do this all the time. We jump in way beyond our depth and then figure it out later. And I think that, in a sense, is the theme of this entire thing. The video is called an experiment right in the beginning. They reference the experiment metaphor many times in several subsequent videos as well. And you can tell that it definitely, the approach is jumping in because of an emotional reaction and figuring it out later. So, is that a bad thing? Is it a bad thing to simplify foreign conflict? Is it a bad thing to jump in because of an emotional reaction? One critique from the blog Wronging Rights says, first, organizations like Invisible Children not only take up resources that could be used to fund more intelligent advocacy, they take up rhetorical space that could be used to develop more intelligent advocacy. I would argue that that isn't necessarily true. I think Invisible Children appears to be capturing resources and rhetorical space that used to be spent on more frivolous things, more frivolous issues. And I think that because the style of videography they use, the music they use, the merchandise they use are all, they target a population that is otherwise uninterested in foreign affairs. They target a population that is quite materialistic and domestic focused. A lot of the visuals they use, a lot of the merchandise and the music is very domestic. It's very hipster. I'll just say it. And it's effective. I think it captures an audience that is otherwise looking elsewhere and brings their attention to something. It does it in a simplistic way. But, you know, the question is, where do we go from there? Where do we go from that simplicity? So the calls to action in the first Kony video was for viewers to forward the link of the video. And this, in a sense, their strategy was to capitalize on the disintermediated networks of social media. So instead of going via traditional media where there are gatekeepers, they were attempting to build a grassroots swell through social media and social media activism. They also call for people to buy the Kony 2012 kit and donate money, which those two are fundraising strategies. And their strategy was smart and simple, again, because buying the kit involved buying hipster T-shirts and posters and stickers that are all pretty cool. In fact, on the Kony 2012 Action Kit website, the first sentence of the description is, "People will think you're an advocate of awesome with this official action kit." So, and it seems flippant, but I think it's actually a really good strategy given their target audience. The fourth action item that the video puts out is to write to celebrities and policymakers. And this is a really interesting tactic that they used, because they understood that you cannot just gain momentum with disintermediated networks. You need to appeal to the official and offline gatekeepers and intermediaries in order to really establish that groundswell. So that's what they did. Invisible Children reached out to many celebrities. I don't know if you can actually see them, but Oprah is on there. So is Mark Zuckerberg. Bono, of course. George Clooney. And then in terms of politicians, they reached out to politicians on both sides of the aisle. So there's a lot of Democrats and Republicans on that particular collage. And the fifth thing that they called people to do was to cover the night. So they integrated offline events into this online campaign. And that's, again, something that's very important, something we've seen many social media campaigns by other nonprofits fail on, because they haven't integrated this online activism with an offline engagement. So Invisible Children were very smart about that. They have a history of being very good at grassroots activism on the ground, offline. As I mentioned before, Invisible Children predates Facebook, and a lot of their activism has been offline, in schools, in colleges, showing the videos, talking to people in person, getting them engaged in person. So releasing the Kony 2012 video and then following that video up with two subsequent videos that, again, called people to attend these two in-person events was very smart of them. So going on to some of the critiques of the campaign, the main one was that it oversimplified the conflict in Uganda and the surrounding countries. It also, another critique was that the conflict is no longer what it used to be. The video portrays the conflict in a context that existed maybe 6 years ago but does not exist anymore. Another critique is that most of the people in the video are Western, or at least the video is very clearly targeted at a Western audience. There's also a critique that conflict is commercialized because of the action kits and because of the appeal that to people to buy posters and T-shirts and bracelets, and that this is going to fix everything. Another critique is that there's an appeal to emotions and there isn't enough thought-provoking content or knowledge to back those emotions up. And so there is a danger of thoughtless action that could come out of this. Another main criticism is that the video calls for the arrest of Kony and his delivery to the ICC. And the arrest is is called for in a militaristic and interventionalist way. So they want the U.S. Army to go in and help the Ugandan government track Kony down, help the Ugandan army track Kony down and arrest him. And so for people in international development who are more peace talk focused and more peace building through development focused, that particular action item was problematic. Another thing is that the video very clearly makes good guys and bad guys. And Kony's the only bad guy talked about, really. Jacob is portrayed as the good guy, the hero of the piece, in a sense, and he's the only hero of the piece, and Kony is the only villain. And this is extremely problematic because there are a lot of actors, both on the side of working for peace and on the side of the conflict, that are not talked about. But again, one aspect of simplification is that you have to leave facts out in order to get the message across. Again, the exclusion of local voices, is justified by Invisible Children because they needed to get a simplistic message out. There are critiques about how they spend their money. They spend a lot of their money on creating these narratives, on doing video work, and not as much, or not as much as people think is necessary, on the ground development work or on the ground peacekeeping work. And then a final critique is the mental breakdown and public arrest of the film's director, who was also portrayed in the film, Jason Russell. So when that happened, a few days after the release of the video and after a lot of the public criticism started coming out, the traditional news media jumped on his mental breakdown and used that in addition to a lot of other criticisms to sort of discredit the organization as a whole. But as I said before, there are a lot of good things about this that we can learn from. The campaign did increase the visibility of an otherwise invisible conflict with an otherwise myopic audience. It also provides a model for other human rights and humanitarian campaigns looking to do similar things. And Invisible Children themselves, I think, learned a lot from this particular campaign and from the criticism, which is hugely to their credit, because a lot of organizations just crumble under such criticism. So in terms of visibility, I don't know if you can see these figures, but they're extremely impressive. Again, for a conflict, for an international conflict with a domestic audience, an American domestic audience, this is very, very difficult to do. 5 million tweets on the video the week that it was released, over 100 million views of the video. Over 13,000% increase in the views of the Invisible Children website. And then on the right side of this infographic, you see, figures on the state of affairs prior to the video. So 4 out of 5 LRA attacks aren't reported by any Western news source. And this isn't surprising. There's a lot of news coming out of the entire world, a lot of conflict, and very, very little of it filters into Western media, and especially little filters into American media. American media is very domestic focused compared to even European and other Western media sources. So there was a huge increase of visibility of this particular conflict. Here's more figures on that. I think you can read this. Yep.
So you got a lot of figures here showing the increase in visibility for that mm-hmm. particular video and that particular organization.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that would be really interesting to look at in order to see if those criticism are
grounded or not, would be the spillover effect on other secondary sources that provide accurate and thorough information about that config that could experience a surge in traffic due to that. And this is what we actually care about.
Yeah.
Right? So do you
absolutely
have any sense, or has anybody looked at this? Are there?
I don't know if anyone's looked at it, but that's a really interesting question. And I think one critique of the video that I think is very valid is there wasn't enough of a gateway to these other sources from Invisible Children. So it's understandable that they cannot be experts in everything. They cannot do the research on the ground, but there are people that are doing the research. So Human Rights Watch has written many, many reports on the conflict on the ground, detailed reports that can easily be linked to from the Invisible Children website. Amnesty International has worked on this campaign on the LRA issue for a while. They've even put out a few videos on the LRA issue, interviewed people on the ground in these communities calling for the ICC to arrest and try Kony. So it's not just Invisible Children that are turning to this ICC solution. Many people on the ground in Uganda and in surrounding countries look to the ICC as one of the main legitimate ways of resolving the conflict and bringing a sense of justice to the community. But the campaign stood in isolation when it could have been integrated more, which is not to say that it cannot still do that. But that's a really good point. And these are all from the Invisible Children website, and these are recent. This didn't exist on the website when the campaign came out. These are updates to the website showing the progress of the campaign after the videos come out and after subsequent videos have come out. So a lot of political action has been taken. You can see there were a few political events, Move DC, which happened in November, and Lobby DC, where Invisible Children rallied people to go to Capitol Hill and lobby with their senators and congresspeople to have the U.S. Fulfill its obligations or its promises with regard to Uganda. And they also have put, Invisible Children has posted on their website information on their programs on the ground, which was lacking in the original Kony 2012 video, information on how much work they actually do on the ground in terms of high-frequency radio stations that they're building all over remote areas of the DRC, Central African Republic, Sudan, Uganda, so that people who are at threat or at risk of having the LRA attack can communicate with each other and can warn each other early. Invisible Children also build schools and build fair trade work environments for people in these communities to give them alternative sources of income and help them establish them, you know, themselves economically. So they do a lot of development work and a lot of conflict prevention work that wasn't addressed in the movie. And here are the four areas in which Invisible Children themselves work. Again, most of their money and most of their attention is spent on media and mobilization, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because if you look at any other nonprofit, they have a specialization and they do what they're good at, and there's nothing wrong with that, in my opinion. One critique that I have is that Invisible Children doesn't just stand up and say, this is what we're good at, and just allow us to do what we're good at. So those are the four areas in which they work. So one of the responses was, as I said before, Jason Russell's mental breakdown. And it's not surprising to me that he had an emotional breakdown, because he was so emotionally tied not only to the cause, but also to the video. And not only was he emotionally tied, but he was in the video. Some of the most intimate moments of his life were in the video. And so the criticism of the video and of the campaign came down hard, not only on his organization, but on him as a human being, as a person. And surprisingly, a lot of people had a huge problem with him, with his son being in the video, with the fact that there was a cute little blonde boy in the video representing this good-evil dichotomy dialogue. So that, you know, is understandably difficult for someone to have to deal with. And the organization as a whole suffered a lot after his breakdown in terms of losing supporters. So they had to recover from that. And one of the ways in which they did that was to release a series of follow-up videos. Kony 2012 Part 2 was the first follow-up video, and addressed more of the context of the conflict, included more Ugandan voices speaking up and saying, this is also what we want. It's not just what this outside American organization is coming and telling us we need. In Kony 2012 Part 2, there's also a discussion of international legal obligations of states, and this is the first time that comes into play. There's a reference to the responsibility to protect commitment by world nations that was signed in 2005, which basically references an obligation that all of a bunch of states signed on to, recognizing the rights of a certain set of human rights, including the rights of children not to be recruited as child soldiers. So this video references that particular commitment and also recognizes that states often don't act on their promises in the international arena. They make promises, and it's very hard to hold them to them. The only way you can do that is by huge domestic pressure or by foreign policy interests like economic, political, or other kinds of pressure from other states. So in terms of the United States, it's very difficult to exert foreign pressure on the U.S., and so that pressure has to come internally, which is sort of the point of this movie. MOVE, which was released in October 2012, and I would really encourage everyone to watch this because it goes through the motivations of Invisible Children in making the Kony 12 video. Jason Russell also addresses his breakdown, and there's a lot of addressing of that particular aspect of the entire situation in MOVE. And then Year in Review, which is the third movie I have up here, is a short one. The other two are 19 minutes and 30 minutes again. Year in Review is about 5 minutes long. It's pretty short, but goes through step by step all of the statistics that I showed you in previous slides. So, you know, I think in their follow-up videos, they did a really good job of bringing in more context, more nuance, more voices. Most of the criticisms that were leveled against Invisible Children, they addressed in those videos pretty well. They've also added more context to their website. So on their website, you now have a list of 10 points that Invisible Children believes it will take to end the LRA conflict. They also have infographics that go into more detail on what they believe is needed. The action they call for is now multinational as well, and this builds on, in part, on a conference that they held in November in Washington, D.C., where they managed to bring together some very high-level politicians from around the world, from Uganda, the DRC, and Sudan, and have them meet together and commit to bringing Kony in and ending the conflict. So Invisible Children has taken a much more multinational approach as well because, in a sense, because they can now leverage their visibility, which they could not do before. So in terms of what we as other practitioners in the field can learn from this particular campaign. I do think it's important to personalize and emotionalize video campaigns. You have to be able to help your audience connect with your target community. And sometimes that does involve simplifying your message, simplifying the content. But as Jerome brought up, it's extremely important to create gateways so that you can take someone who's drawn in by an emotional connection and lead them through to a more nuanced and contextual understanding of the issue. Another really interesting thing that Invisible Children did that I didn't address before, and this is something that the marketing community has learned about viral videos, is a way to keep people's attention, and this is a long video for a viral video, it's 30 minutes long. A way to keep people's attention is to pulse positive messaging with tragic or emergency messaging. If you have too much of one thing, people lose interest. And so in Kony 2012, they did a really good job of that. In the beginning, you have this euphoric, we are the new generation of social media and we can change the world. And then you have the tragic issues in the middle of the video, where you see Jacob and you see his grief, and then you see Kony and you see the brutality of his actions. And then they quickly bring in a positive emotion again because they don't want to lose you in that despair. So it's actually something that works pretty well, something that worked very well in that video. And Invisible Children has continued to do that in their subsequent videos as well. Again, integrating old school mainstream media is still essential if you want to take your online campaigns and bring them offline. Integrating offline events and physical ties to the cause, that's merchandising and the cover the night and the events on the ground is also extremely important. Time sensitivity, I didn't address this before, but one thing about the Kony 2012 video is that they bring a sense of urgency to the video. They say 2012 is the year we're going to get Kony. This video is 27 minutes long. And there's a countdown in the video, there's a countdown to the end of the year, and it makes you feel a sense of urgency, but you don't really know why 2012 is the year. Why is it an emergency this year? Well, last year. In the Move video, they address that, and Invisible Children say it wasn't really an external emergency, it was an internal one within their organization. They felt a sense that they were running out of steam, and this was a last-ditch effort, all chips in, we're going to go all or nothing. So it's a very interesting case where they took an internal sense of emergency and externalized it, and it seemed to work. Not many people asked the question, why 2012? What is it about this year that Kony must be caught? Another thing that I think Invisible Children learned from and will integrate in the future is that they need to stay more relevant to needs on the ground. If the issue that you're dealing with is 6 years old, pivot and talk about the issue on the ground now. People are still being captured. It's not 30,000 child soldiers anymore, but 280 people captured in the past year is still a lot. I think they've learned that as well. And the integration of easy calls to action is something very, very important. Clicktivism is a criticism that people have leveled against Kony 2012, but they integrated a lot of offline events and activities that I think take them beyond that criticism and beyond what a lot of other nonprofits trying to do online campaigns haven't been able to achieve. So I'd like to open it up to discussion now because I think it is a very controversial campaign, very controversial issue, and I'd like some of those controversies to be brought up so we can discuss. Go ahead.
So one thing that I think Jason Russell's mental breakdown was something that was seized upon by critics, and something that I think was devastating to the Invisible Children, because you no longer have to engage with the substance of the issue. You can just say, oh, well, Jason Russell's crazy. But I would level the same criticism inversely against Invisible Children with their video Move. I mean, if I recall correctly, as you mentioned, a lot of Move has to do with Jason Russell's breakdown. And something that I am concerned about is that they actually try to reframe the criticism as being not about substance, but about being about Jason Russell's breakdown, so that once they answered that question, they didn't have to answer the more substantive criticisms. And I mean, another example within the Move is you had, you know, I remember when they showed a bunch of YouTube critical responses, mm-hmm. and one person said, well, this is the Illuminati, right? And it's meant to be somewhat joking, but it's also meant to reframe the criticism so that we have an understanding that it's more of a knee-jerk reaction to the to the organization, mm-hmm. than to you know, their actual actions. Maybe this is a bit of a question with the period, but I was wondering if, you know, if you think that's fair, or if you know, Move as a video did a better job of getting to the actual substantive criticisms, or was it just reframing?
I don't think it did a better job of getting to the substance. I think it was it was a reactionary video, and it was in response to the fallout of the initial video. And so one of the things that they had to address, Invisible Children released a video in April after Jason Russell had already had his breakdown, and they did not address his breakdown in that video. They were trying to bring people back to the actual substantive issues. And that didn't really work. The Cover the Night event was 3 days after Kony 2012 Part 2 was released, and sort of they, you know, did not have the reaction they were hoping to have, did not have the kinds of on-the-street advocacy, even though all of their action kits had sold out. So hundreds of thousands of people had spent $30 on a kit to go out and canvas their neighborhoods, but for some reason did not go out and canvas. And one of the reasons that Invisible Children probably thought affected that was his mental breakdown and the fact that they did not address it. So I think Move was an attempt to deal with that. And it's very interesting to see them try and walk the line between addressing every single criticism, including financial criticisms, this very personal breakdown, which unfortunately had a very public aspect to it. And then the fact that attention was diverted totally away from the actual cause to the organization and its founder. So that's an answer with a question mark at the end.
Considering that a good portion of Kony 2012's viewers were around in their teens, mid-20s, wouldn't you say that, considering with Jason Russell's breakdown, that a good number of them didn't know about it and wouldn't go out canvassing because of that?
You know, everybody saw it.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah.
But just the last part.
Yeah, so considering that a lot of young people don't necessarily know about Jason Russell's breakdown, what would be some other reasons why they didn't go out canvassing and use those toolkits? Was it that wide? I don't remember if it was that widespread.
I think they did know. It was arguably more in the news than the original campaign, because it was just so sensational. He was running around naked in the streets. You know, it's perfect news fodder. So I would argue that they did know.
So this can't. I must be one of the people who heard a lot about the campaign, then did not know until you mentioned that what had happened afterward. But okay, it's now 2013. Kony is presumably still at large. There hasn't been a U.S. military intervention. So if they didn't succeed in those two goals in 2012,
mm-hmm.
how do they stay relevant in 2013 and keep people focused on it when there was so much energy put into this? This was supposed to happen last year.
That's a really good question, and that's the risk you run when you put a deadline on your campaign. They went all out in 2012. They said, this is the end, and now it's 2013, and their Kony 2012 T-shirts are on sale for $10 because... I don't know if I have the answer to that. I don't know how you recover from that.
Have they gotten any closer to the field? If I recall, they were trying to get a U.S. military intervention to occur. I don't think they got anywhere close to that goal.
No, but some of their other goals, one was fundraising, and they were very successful at that in 2012 because of this campaign. And another was to use those funds to do more of the on-the-ground work that they're currently doing. So to build more radio stations, to build more schools, help more small businesses and give out more scholarships. And so I think in those senses, they have been successful. In terms of capturing this one individual, no. And I don't know how successful they're going to be on that particular action item.
Yeah, maybe a reply to that. I think
in the end, what was said about the end of the campaign is a bit unfair on Invisible Children. I mean, I have my reserves on the whole thing, but it wasn't so unsuccessful. The thing, I think one of the mistakes was identifying, you know, that by 2012 we have to get Kony captured, which didn't happen. But if you ask Africans and Ugandans, and they say Kony's out of all those countries, he's out of Central Africa, he's hidden somewhere, he's got almost nobody. I mean, he wasn't captured, because obviously he had a lot of... But he's out of the picture, completely. So,
but the problem still exists without him, right?
Well, yeah. But the problem was Kony. The problem, that address wasn't, you know, peace in Central Africa, it was just Kony. And to be fair, they didn't capture him, but some of that did change a lot. Like, maybe so from the tactical perspective, part of the having such a well-delimited target is probably a tactical mistake, because they could have, you know, maybe it served the purpose of getting people excited about a very specific thing, but much of the cause was driven forward.
I have many
reserves about the campaign, but on that, I think, to be fair.
Or you could argue that it was a tactical mistake in terms of the population here not seeing this goal achieved. But in terms of populations, in terms of the target populations, having a single pinpointed target for this population to focus on and rally around and fund, and then using that funding to fund other more nuanced activities that have actually helped those populations out fine. So the only population that's really duped and feeling unfulfilled is the one here, which is fine. Like, as long as you don't have to appeal to them again.
Yeah. In terms of strategy and tactics, the two areas that I didn't hear you talk about in terms of improvement, one is the mobilization logistics of material. Mm-hmm. There are real problems in fulfillment. And movement of materials to especially the youth and young adult communities that were so brilliantly activated and made aware.
Yep.
Second, the maybe missteps or learnings about sustaining mobilization and engagement of youth and young adult populations. I think there was a great deal of wishful thinking about the degree of momentum and how that would carry out into execution at the street level. So I'm very curious to know, what's the organization learned, or what have you evaluated as some of the insights into maintaining mobilization engagement? Because I think the reaction of the organization, and this is a statement, the reaction of the organization to the Founders Breakdown, I thought was rather immature in terms of hiding out in shame, not being as aggressive, letting that be the story that carried, as opposed to being more aggressive and countering the story. I thought it was a real disservice for supposedly such a media savvy organization not to be able to pivot itself more aggressively and appeal to the larger issues, and in some ways shame the press about making the kind of case it was making. So
yeah. Okay, so three things you brought up there. The first, the logistical aspects and the fact that they did break down in fulfillment. They addressed that in MOVE, and this is one of the main things that I've noticed in looking into this campaign, is that it blew up way too big for them, way bigger than they expected it to, way bigger than anyone else expected it to. And so the main critiques of this campaign really are that it got too big. If Invisible Children had managed to have 2,000 people buy action kits and go out into the streets and lobby Congress, everyone would have said, that's an amazing job that you got 2,000 people to care about the LRA. But because they got 100 million people to care, suddenly it's like, well, the LRA isn't important enough for 100 million people to care about anymore, you know? And, you know, a lot of the fulfillment issue is the same thing. They weren't expecting that many people to order action kits. And so when they failed on fulfillment, when their website crashed and they had to send people to their Tumblr instead, and then everyone thought they were a fake organization because they're an internet organization that doesn't have a website. All of these things are failures of getting too big and being too successful. The same thing with not being able to pivot the Jason Russell mental breakdown. I think they were just so overwhelmed as a young, both as an organization and as a group of people, organization, they didn't know how to react. So I don't really know what the solution is to that, except that they are probably now taking stock and learning and trying to, you know, strategize and plan their way forward. And I think they're generally quite a savvy and smart organization. They've learned now that they can scale that big, and they probably will prepare for that kind of scale the next time they run a campaign. In terms of replicability for other organizations, I don't know if there's any way you can tell that you're going to make it that big until you do, and then until you buckle under the pressure of having gained that much exposure.
I actually first watched the Kony 2012 video last night, and coming to the video with an awareness of the massive viral hit that it became, and mm-hmm. seeing all the links that my friends posted on Facebook last spring, it seemed to almost be a self-fulfilling prophecy of sorts, and that video devotes so much of its running time to, like, the power of the internet, the power of social networking. And I was curious if any other, you know, groups like Invisible Children have attempted to kind of sensationalize, like, the power of mass media and the internet in the same way. Because I think part of the video's success was in that it made people excited about how, like, through the internet they could make a difference and not just sensationalize like the issues.
I'm not aware of that many other organizations that have done it very successfully. I know there's a really interesting YouTube fundraising project where two guys have gotten together, and YouTube is somehow affiliated, and they crowdfund fundraise to give away money to one or two nonprofits, and they do that through having crowdsourcing video fundraising videos. So it's crowd-based in several aspects. It's YouTube affiliated. But it's kind of hard to understand. I mean, it's really hard for me to explain, and so maybe that's where it falls. But I haven't really come across any that have been as successful as Invisible Children. Amnesty International has some very good campaign videos, but I think their most viewed video is under 10,000 views still.
I wanted to touch upon two things. So transparency and, like, credibility and how they link together. So you mentioned before that they had their four areas, what they were, mm-hmm. they were good at, and one of them was media and the other was mobilization. And you said it would be better if they were upfront about saying this is what we're good at, and along with creating those other gateways that, you know, the drillability that you know, Ethan Zuckerman and other people talk about. But I'm also wondering just how that, if that would have, if being more transparent would have eased a little the issue of what happened with Russell's breakdown. And then another thing, I'm not sure how much this affected the credibility of their organization, but then like the leaked cables about involvement with government agencies and collaboration with to get the military intervention in Uganda and these countries. I'm just wondering, you know, it seems to be that there's a careful balance there where on the one hand, transparency probably would help it, but then on the other hand, you did have a lot of these, well, mainly Brussels breakdown, but then further down the line when there was more investigation of the organization, things like the leaked cables that really came down hard on the organization. So I'm just wondering what's your assessment of how organizations can learn from that? Or...
It's you can never be completely transparent as an organization. One, because people don't want to know all of that information until a scandal happens and then they want to dig it up. And two, it's not appropriate to reveal. I don't think any organization is completely transparent about everything that goes on. But one thing they did attempt to do, which I think was the right thing to do, is to once people started trying to dig into their finances and their background, is to be as transparent on those issues as they could. And I think that's all any nonprofit or anyone having someone delve into your closet is just be like, well, here it is. But no, I don't think upfront complete transparency is appropriate for nonprofits.
Question mark at the end of it. But I remember when I was in high school, which was a little while ago, Invisible Children came to my high school and did show a presentation, you know, sort of resembled Kony 2012 and a lot of the sort of media used and a lot of the sort of action items that were bracelets. And I would like to push back based on that a little bit on your sort of like, oh, it doesn't matter that this we activated this broader set of people who gave money and now don't see anything coming out of their work, because I think that's the tactic that they use sort of when I remember being in high school. It was sort of an overly simplistic view of what was happening in Uganda. They got the same pushback then, like, you know, wait, I don't think this represents the full story. I remember people asking their teachers about, like, hey, so can we learn more about this, which is great, but that Invisible Children sort of wasn't linking out, wasn't creating that. So, I mean, I guess that I'm a little skeptical about sort of like, oh, they're really good at media and mobilization and they should just focus on that, because I think that what it does is it turns people off sort of compassion fatigue style on getting involved in these kind of projects, because what they see is I tried, I did these things and nothing even came out of it at all. And like when I saw 2012 come out, I was like, oh god, it's Invisible Children, like these people who came to my high school and nothing ever came of it. So I guess it's really hard for me to, like, hear, it's like, oh, it's great that we reached all these people, and, oh, nothing happened, and that's totally fine, it was a successful campaign. I think it's better if you reach less people and actually activate them more fully, and actually, you know, people gain more knowledge about what's going on and get a completer picture, like, you know, quality over quantity.
I agree, quality over quantity, but wouldn't it be great if we could get that quantity to quality? And we're halfway there with this campaign. That's where I see the potential. How do you then link this ground surge with some actual follow-through? And I think Invisible Children gets us more there today in 2013 than they did 10 years ago when they were at your high school, or even a year ago when they released Kony 2012. If you look on their website today, there are a lot of link-throughs to other reports and other agencies, a lot more than they used to have. But there can be more. And I think other agencies should also reach out to Invisible Children and organizations like them and use them. So, you know, Human Rights Watch could use invisible children or work in conjunction with them to run a campaign together so that you've got experts on the context, on the ground, working with experts in media and communication, which is what I see invisible children as more than anything.
Along the same lines, in your own work, you have all these lessons. Which one of them do you think could apply to musicians or other cases that are social justice oriented, but maybe smaller in scale, not exactly humanitarian crisis issues? How do you, or what lessons have you taken that you'll apply yourself?
The lessons that I've taken, you probably won't like because they're the commercial and fundraising ones. And again, this comes down to the scale, right? So every nonprofit has merchandise. Every nonprofit wants to sell them. But as soon as you sell 500 million T-shirts, people feel dirty about the fact that you're a nonprofit and you've done so well at T-shirt sales. But that's something. I look to Invisible Children as a model for merchandising. And for small donation, raising donations and raising memberships from small-scale values but large-scale quantity. And that's something they have been really good at. They haven't been good at sustaining interest and engagement on an intellectual level, but they've been really good at fundraising on this really large scale.
So it seems to me that attention is a precursor to action.
Mm-hmm.
And so just within an attention economy framework, they've done a spectacular job getting people to notice. And I wonder if there's a different way of evaluating the success of campaigns if it was about removing Kony. That's not necessarily the mode to evaluate this campaign on. It's simply a matter of opening up discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And to that, I think that it's really interesting to me that the video was 30 minutes. And I don't know any, well, that's extreme. I know very few people who actually watched it, right? So it was, there is this meta text that was built around the video. And I think that's really important to think about the video and all of the meanings of that video and how it kind of manifests itself within social media in one sort or another, outside of, and the narrative becomes assumed and related as opposed to actually consumed.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And also the subsequent discussions that evolved out of it, by and between people who may or may not have watched the video either, but are relying on this sort of narrative that's been perpetrated by or propagated by the news media and by blogs and now a little bit academic articles. There still aren't that many academic articles on the issue or the campaign, but the discourse that followed the video is almost can stand on its own almost as something to evaluate and to dig into, because it generated a very rich discourse in its wake, beginning days after most of the articles and blogs on Kony 2012 came out in the week after the video came out. And there's not that much afterwards. The academic articles came out a month or two after that. But I think the conversation should continue and the analysis should continue. There's a lot to unpack that hasn't yet been unpacked.
To me, that the important point here is not that those people elicited emotional reactions through their video per se, but the important question is how do you channel that energy afterwards to get people to act upon it in a useful way. And so I wonder whether and who were the critics who attacked that video on the emotional incitation angle, as like there seems to be a sense in which everybody expects a commercial to be entertaining, fun, eliciting emotional reactions, right? But as long as like you come to a serious subject, the only way to enter it would be through information overload and boredom. So, which seems to me like a very bad strategy to like get people's interest. If you look at any good lecture, academic lecture, that's what people do, right? They attract you with some kind of picture or something, then they give you a frame that's totally like elusive about what they're going to say, and then they dig in once you're with them.
Yeah.
So it's a very bad understanding of what like this whole is. So were there really people who were like upset with the fact that this elicited emotions per se? And I'm also interested in like who were those critics more generally, and what was their stake in that particular issue for them to step in?
Yeah, there was a lot of criticism on the emotional aspect, more on the fact that it was emotions that weren't backed up by thought. So emotions that would lead to action that was based on not enough context, basically. And those reactions were from academics, of course.
which probably be bad at doing those things.
Yeah. And there was the anti-commercialization reaction was also mostly an academic one. And I guess from when I say academic, it's often practitioners who are also researching and writing on the issues. So practitioners in the nonprofit human rights field. So we working in this field we walk this line of needing funding and needing to reach out beyond grant funding to other sources, but feeling dirty about purely commercial sources like merchandising. And I think that critique came from that. It wasn't so much about invisible children as it was about our own shame at this way of fundraising. One more question.
I saw online somewhere a campaign that it was about getting pop stars recording coming home songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the idea is that there are now all these kids out there who are involved in this stuff, and they're horribly embarrassed or have various psychological issues about what they've done, and they're afraid to come home. And there were local indigenous songs that got recorded and get broadcast to try and encourage the kids to go home, and this has been effective. And I'm curious if Invisible Children is involved with that, or if that's a separate thing. And I wonder the extent to which this as a template might is what you might do moving forward. So, for instance, you might say, as was observed, with the great efforts of lots of people and many forces, Kony is now marginalized, but now you have to deal with the reality of a place that has been scarred by these decades. And this would sort of enable one to say, okay, something has happened, but now what are the set of things you have to do to deal with reality? And also it might allow the tying in of the personal narrative of you have a place that's psychologically scarred, that had a breakdown, and it has to recover, and this is, you know, might help to tie a bunch of things together.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would be a really good place for Invisible Children to move into. So move away from targeting Kony per se and more towards rehabilitation and healing. The Coming Home campaign, I believe, was a UN-sponsored campaign, and the UN subbed out a lot of the aspects of it to different organizations. So I know Invisible Children did the flyers. They made flyers for this campaign and would airdrop them across vast expanses of jungle where Kony and his army were believed to be. And they've had some success with people coming back to their communities, holding these flyers and saying, this is the reason I came home. They also, from the radio stations that they've built, broadcast coming home messaging. So they've been very involved in that aspect of it. Yeah.
They just started a rehabilitation program in the GRC. That just opened up last month.
And they also do focus a lot of their on-the-ground initiatives on education, like schools, not only elementary schools, but also high schools, and then sending children in the region on to college, and then also on, like, you kind of touched on this a little, like, sustainable, fair trade, like, economic growth for the area, so that they have something to go back to.
Right, I think...